This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 29th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 314 and happy Halloween. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature, this week's guest, British Columbia's Ombudsperson Jay Chalk. The independent watchdog since 2015 discusses the challenges he faces in keeping government accountable to citizens. Is it just me, or are these scary and spooky times for the federal Liberal government? The carbon tax is temporarily gone on home heating oil until after the next election, but not in every province. In BC, the NDP government was caught by surprise when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made his October 26th announcement. Clearly, Trudeau thinks he's treating Canadians while tricking Pierre Poilievre by stealing a promise from the Conservative platform, but it probably won't make a difference in the opinion polls. The Liberals are running scared. They quashed a committee meeting about the lack of investigation into the SNC-Lavalin scandal. They also don't want a public inquiry into how they mishandled the pandemic. At least 54,000 Canadians died, and it was preventable. But Ottawa was not prepared. Trudeau had other priorities on his mind at the end of 2019 and start of 2020, such as seeking a seat on the United Nations Security Council. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Established in 1979, British Columbia's Office of the Ombudsperson is the independent voice for fairness and accountability in public services. Jay Chalk, the Ombudsperson since 2015, has 1,000 public bodies under his jurisdiction. Last year, the office received more than 7,300 complaints and inquiries, mainly about public body decisions or outcomes, processes and procedures, and the way they communicate. ICBC and the Ministries of Children and Family Development and Social Development and Poverty Reduction attracted the most complaints. On October 25th, Jay Chalk appeared before the legislature's Finance Committee to seek a $14.7 million budget for next year. Government gets bigger and more complex, so the Ombudsperson needs more resources. In September, I interviewed Ombudsperson Chalk about his office and how it keeps government accountable.
So people can turn to us a number of different ways. And as you say, we're the complaints body, as it were, for people who believe that they have been treated unfairly or unreasonably by any one of over 1,000 public bodies in British Columbia. We're a general jurisdiction ombuds office, and that means that we have jurisdiction over government ministries, crown corporations, school districts, health authorities, local governments, all manner of agency boards and commissions. So kind of a one-stop shop for people who are concerned about the fairness of the service they receive. So people can come reach out to us a number of different ways. Phone is our favorite because then we can have a conversation with the person. But people can also, we have an online form. So 24/7, people can make their complaints that way. We also take the office out on the road a few times a year, and that's an in-person opportunity as well. About 8,000 times a year, people turn to us for assistance with some government body. And when they do, that typically takes one of about six pathways. And in about four of those pathways, comprising about 87% of those complaints and inquiries, the response or assignment is very quick, within a day or a few days. And that might be if they're complaining about, say, the federal government, for example. Sometimes people don't understand how federalism works necessarily. And so if we get a complaint, say, about the Department of Veterans Affairs, a Canadian Forces veteran didn't get their veterans pension check that month, we can't investigate them, but there's a veterans ombudsman. So we're able to make a referral to someone who can help them. But sometimes it's a public body that we do have jurisdiction over, say someone like WorkSafe, who have a number of review processes built in for people who are unhappy with those services. And so in those circumstances, we're saying, well, have you tried this particular method of reconsideration, say that WorkSafe has, and if they haven't, we say, go do that. And if you're still unhappy, come back. Other times, it's a breakdown of communications, relatively straightforward. We'll send it to one of our early resolution officers, and their goal is to start and finish that early resolution within 10 days. And then sometimes it's a matter that has to go for formal investigation, but it's urgent and it relates to life, health, or safety. And that gets an immediate assignment to one of our investigators. So that, as I said, it's about 87% of those complaints and inquiries fall into that category. And about another 5% or so, the assignment's happening within a week. Those are a next level of urgency down. And then there are matters that are not urgent, that the investigation can occur. It won't be impacted by when we start it. We try to get those as quickly as we can. That has been impacted in terms of the starting of those investigations by the pandemic. And I'm happy to talk about the impact that the pandemic has had on us. But with the settling of the pandemic, we're hoping to, return to a more prompt assignment in the remaining about 8% of our cases.
One of my readers said that there is a backlog, that when he complained about a local government procurement matter in August, was told that files were starting to be dealt with that were made in March. What is the current backlog, and how has it changed?
So as I said, though, that 8% of our files are the ones that are non-urgent matters that have been referred to an investigator. And those are the ones that the one that your caller may have referred to may be one of those. And I expect it probably is. And we just always keep that list under constant triage. Something that is not urgent can become urgent. And so we can start a matter at any time, but there may be files that do spend a few months, as it were, before assignment to an investigator. And we do that so that investigators have caseloads that they can give a full attention to and move through their case list. So we could assign those matters more quickly, but then investigators would have a bigger caseload. So and we want to make those caseloads manageable so that they're able to, once they start an investigation, move through it promptly. And they do. So that's the approach we take. Once a matter is signed to an investigator, about 32% of those are closed within 30 days, another 30% within 90 days. So we try to manage balance both starting the investigation and also the workload for investigators. So we have had the non-urgent assignments down to as short as 2 weeks a few years ago, but the pandemic has definitely had an impact. Instability in public services. We investigate 1,000 public bodies, and I don't know, Bob, but you probably can't think of one that didn't change its service delivery during the pandemic. And our job is to investigate a complaint. And so we try to know a lot about those 1,000 bodies, public bodies, and how they operate. But during the pandemic, that was very challenging because people would call us and say, well, this happened. And, really, given the instability that was inherent in public services at the time, we'd had to, do a lot more work just trying to find out what those public services were. So that has slowed any, I think, operation down. But now that we're moving into the post-pandemic period, I'm hopeful that we can return to that assignment for non-urgent investigations within a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the historical budget, for instance, for the office back in 2017-2018. It was $6.5 million. And by 2021-2022, it became $10.8 million. So that reflects the need for more resources. What is the current resource that you have right now in terms of personnel, especially the personnel who are the ones who are there for the intake, who take the complaints, and then the personnel who then therefore are the ones who investigate the complaints?
You bet. So we have 10 staff who do an intake, work on intake, and another eight investigators on each of three teams that conduct complaints investigations. In addition, and part of that budget that you're talking about, and most of the growth, frankly, was not related to complaint investigations, because those haven't changed that much in terms of volume. What has changed among those has been sort of a high grading of complexity, as you alluded to, and the pandemic have been challenges in there. But most of the increase, frankly, has gone to new statutory obligations that my office has arising under the Public Interest Disclosure Act, as well as a new program that we started to do preventative ombudsmanship. In other words, help public bodies avoid unfairness in the first place. So we do lots of training and consulting with public bodies, as well as an initiative to build trust and expand awareness in Indigenous communities. So that's really been the primary area of growth in the budget. But with respect to complaint investigations, really primarily, it has been those factors that relate to the pandemic and I would say the complexity of government, as you alluded to before.
The report that you did about the health researchers firings was perhaps the most egregious example here in BC. How, from your standpoint, how has your office evolved and how has that protection for whistleblowers evolved as it's come into effect?
Well, as you mentioned, the health firings investigation, as a result of that in our report, one of the recommendations I made was that government consider passing or introducing for the legislature to consider passing public interest disclosure or whistleblowing legislation, and British Columbia ultimately did, making it was the last province in Canada to do so, and the second last to bring it into force. And so it did come as a result of a report that we did, and then government has chosen to implement it and across the broader public sector, and has chosen to do so in seven phases. We are now just through phase four, as it were. So government ministries are covered, about some 30 tribunals, 30 crown corporations, all the health authorities. And that was really, that just happened in June. And that was the biggest expansion that tripled the number of public employees who have disclosure rights under the act, because it's only public employees and current and former public employees who have disclosure rights. So that went up threefold on June 1st when the act was brought in for them. And then on December 1st, all employees of school districts, the K-12 system, will be covered by the act. And then next year, the post-secondary system. So at that point, there'll be over 300,000 public employees who will have rights under the act. So we're still in an implementation time. But I think that it's an important element of ensuring, transparency in government, accountability, and promoting, integrity and speak up culture. And a lot of the time that I spend talking to leaders of public bodies who are about to be covered by the act, I say, this is your opportunity to, really speak up as an organizational leader about the value of integrity and the importance of speaking up and welcoming your employees who speak up and when they see something wrong. Because I think we all want to work for an organization that says that, and the act lets people disclose internally if they want, but if they're not comfortable with that, they can make their disclosure to our office and then we investigate.
Do you also look at BC Ferries?
So interesting. That's a great question, Bob. So it's one of the only only public bodies we've ever lost jurisdiction over. We used to have jurisdiction over BC Ferries, but in the early part of the millennium, you will recall that the Campbell government spun BC Ferries out. And when they did so, one of the things that they did was to, long before my time, the idea, I guess, was to move it away from government. So one of the things that they did was they specifically provided in the Coastal Ferries Act that the Ombudsperson Act does not apply to things done under the Coastal Ferries Act. So we don't have jurisdiction. We do have jurisdiction over the Ferries Commissioner, but we don't have jurisdiction over BC Ferries itself. I do think that the public have a right to seek some sort of external complaint mechanism, and it's something I'd like to see returned at some point in the future.
And you of course look at a lot of financial and service issues, economic issues, but you have been doing reports in recent months that do look at social issues. Over the summer, there was the Time to Right the Wrong report about the confinement of Dukhobor children historically here in British Columbia, and also a report called Misinformed about problems inside the Ministry of Children and Family Development regarding permanency planning and obligations to youth in care. You know, one historical case and one case of the Ministry of Children and Family Development, which has had a spotlight on it for a number of years because of some of the tragedies that have happened there. I wonder if you can talk about both reports and just summarize them and what you hope those reports will do in the long run.
So with respect to Time to Right the Wrong, as you mentioned, it relates to the long ago time from the 1950s, removal of children from parents in the West Kootenays who were children of Dukhobors, many of them members of the Sons of Freedom sect, and who were sent to a school that then had a fence built by those children, by the way, to keep them in and keep their parents out. And some of them stayed there up to 6 years. Our office has had a long-standing interest in it. Our first report dates back to 1999. We then wrote a second report in 2003, and then now this report. And I was very pleased that that the Attorney General indicated in her reply to that most recent report that the government is going to accept one of our recommendations back from 1999, and for the first time has indicated that the government will be apologizing. So I'm looking forward to that. And our other recommendation was that compensation be paid to these then children, now mostly in their 70s and 80s, elderly people, about for what happened to them. The government has not yet committed to compensating them, although they have said that they are working on what they describe as a recognition package. I'm certainly urging the Attorney General to include compensation in that recognition package. So we're looking forward to it. I was quite focused on ensuring that there'd be some time horizon on this. And I was pleased to see that the Attorney General indicated that those things would be happening this fall. With respect to that recent report that you mentioned, Misinformed, about the Ministry of Children and Families, I guess that's maybe perhaps I should take a lesson from Time to Right the Wrong and recognize that maybe it just takes a while for something to happen, because unfortunately this was a report where our recommendations were not accepted by government, and that doesn't happen very often in our world. I will say that the only other time, and I've been the ombudsperson now for more than 8 years, I did a report with respect to WorkSafe, and that's the only other time that I've had a report where government has been as unwilling as they were in Misinformed to address our recommendations. But it was a young person who was about to become an adult, or sorry, was 17, and before she became an adult, the ministry proposed a particular pathway with respect to the remainder of her minority from she was 17 until 19. She was interested in going to post-secondary and asked what effect this proposed pathway would have on her eligibility for public funding, because there is public funding for kids in care who, when they turn 19, are still in care for them to go to university and college. And she was told it wouldn't have any effect, and that was wrong. And ultimately, she consented to that change. And when she went to school, was then surprised to find out that she was ineligible. So I had a number of recommendations, including she be compensated, that an audit be conducted to figure out whether this happened to anybody else, and that additional protections be put in the form of giving the public guardian and trustee a role in these cases to look out for the financial interests of kids in these situations. And the ministry so far has declined to make those changes. So we'll continue to advocate for that. I'm very hopeful that over time the ministry will reflect on their position and change that.
Thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. Jay Chalk, who's the ombudsperson for British Columbia. The Ombudsperson's Office is British Columbia's independent voice for fairness and accountability in public services. That's where you go if you've got questions or complaints about provincial or municipal public services in BC.
Thanks, Bob.
For more information, go to bcombudsperson.ca. Now it's time.
podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Nazi flags waved outside Taipei European School draw condemnation. Two protesting individuals from Old German Mark Association reportedly responsible. These actions have a detrimental impact on Taiwan's image, said the government, which also said that Taiwan is a free and democratic country and freedom of speech is protected by the Constitution. However, it called on citizens to, quote, respect the feelings of other nations and people. It pointed out that the Nazi flag represents racism and genocide and is a, quote, very painful memory in European history. In Kyoto news, hay fever fighting rice to be part of Japan's economic stimulus. The government aims to commence clinical trials of the transgenic rice, which will be powdered and processed into tablets or capsules, in fiscal 2024, with plans to commercialize the drug within the next 10 years. Since fiscal 2000, the Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries has been working on developing the rice produced by genetically modifying rice crops to contain peptides from Japanese cedar pollen allergens. In the Hong Kong Free Press, donation at center of HKU misconduct scandal came from firm under U.S. import ban over alleged forced Uyghur labor. The University of Hong Kong received $10.8 million from Nine Star Corporation via the Chinese Red Cross Foundation in April. Laser printer company Nine Star and eight of its Zhuhai-based subsidiaries were added to the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act entry list by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in June. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Oregon's abysmal chronic attendance problem grew even worse last year, state reveals. More than 38% of Oregon students missed at least 3 weeks of school in 2022-2023, an even grimmer number than the previous year when students first returned to school buildings full-time. Approximately 200,000 students were considered chronically absent, defined as missing at least 10% of school days, setting them up for not learning to read and failing to graduate from high school, according to the Oregon Department of Education. An astonishing 45% of Oregon kindergartners missed school that often. In King 5, afraid of losing their wings, pilots may not seek mental health care. Experts say few outside the aviation industry realize that the risk pilots take when admitting mental health struggles and how it could jeopardize their careers. In the wake of an off-duty Alaska Airlines pilot's alleged attempt to shut down a plane's engines mid-flight last weekend, investigators have started to reveal some of their initial findings. Joseph Emerson reportedly told police he was having a, quote, nervous breakdown and had not slept in 40 hours after taking psychedelic mushrooms for the first time. It is unclear exactly if or when Emerson sought professional help for his mental health struggles. Regardless, his case raises many questions around flight crew judgment, mental health, and well-being. In the Times Colonist, thunderstorm warning in aviation forecast on day when helicopter struck by lightning. Forecast included risk of thunderstorm activity over most of the south coast, says meteorologist. Environment Canada had warned of a risk of thunderstorms Tuesday morning when a Helijet S-76 Sikorsky helicopter, flying between Vancouver and Victoria, was struck by lightning. The helicopter, with two pilots and 12 passengers, landed safely in Victoria after descending through 3,000 feet of clouds without instruments. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
the 31,000 nonprofit organizations across BC communities and the 335,000 people who work at them. October 30th is Not-for-Profit Recognition Day in BC.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
These rich men know the rich men, Lord knows. want to know what you do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do, because your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end, because they're rich men, north of rich men.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of October 29th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 29th of October in 1863, 18 countries met in Geneva to form the International Red Cross? So important whenever there is a war, famine, or natural disaster. Tip of the hat to the International Red Cross. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. If you're in Canada, you can't get Facebook updates due to the Trudeau Liberals' Bill C-18, so why not subscribe to the newsletter or follow The Breaker News on Twitter, also known as X. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.